Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
State leaders call Florida's reduction in debt unprecedented.
We paid down $7.1 billion of direct debt over the last 8 years.
Also this week, the race for Florida Agriculture Commissioner heats up, with one hot topic being a certain crop that's legal when used as prescribed by a doctor.
What I would like to see is more licensees to meet the market demand for those products. I do think DOH did not want to have this responsibility.
We'll also get a uniquely informed viewpoint of how all those multitasking constitutional amendments got on this year's ballot, and hear from those who believe one of the best things for Florida is oil and natural gas exploration off the state's coasts. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. All right, let's start off the show with a couple of pieces of legitimately good news. One piece is Florida's latest unemployment figure. For the month of July, it ticked down to 3.7%, 2/10 of a percentage point less than the June number. To find a Florida unemployment number that low, you have to go all the way back to April of 2007. That was right before the bottom dropped out of the housing market and the Great Recession started kicking the state's jobless rate up towards the double digits. So that's one bit of positive news. Here's another. Florida is $21 billion in debt, and state leaders were actually happy to hear that number at the most recent Florida cabinet meeting. The money's being used to finance initiatives like transportation and environmental projects. Gina Jordan reports the debt has fallen in recent years, bolstered in part by low interest rates and the economy.
Division of Bond Finance Director Ben Watkins calls the reduction in debt unprecedented. It's a sea change, he says, in terms of reversing what had been decades of perpetual debt increases. He told the Florida Cabinet the state's paying down of debt has two components.
One is the direct debt that we issue for roads, school, acquisition of conservation land, et cetera. We paid down $7.1 billion of direct debt over the last 8 years. And we've also, the second component of that, are federal advances from the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund, and we've repaid aggregate advances of $3.4 billion also over the last 8 years. So you add that up, it's $10.5 billion.
The state's debt has fallen 25% since July of 2010. That's substantial, says Florida State University economics professor Randall Holcomb, especially at a time when most states are building up unfunded liabilities.
In most governments, you look at how much spending is increasing, and not only is Florida's state government spending not increasing, it's actually been decreasing over a period of a couple of decades. So that's pretty remarkable. That's the budget side, and it goes along with the fiscal conservatism on the debt.
The state deployed several tactics to cut its borrowing. Watkins says part of the bond finance division's strategy was refinancing a lot of loans, which managed to save the state a few billion dollars.
This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take advantage of historically low interest rates, and this is what we've been able to accomplish. Over the last 8 years, 104 transactions totaling $14.7 billion. That is over 70% of our debt portfolio that's been refinanced at lower interest rates.
It doesn't reduce the total amount of debt, but it reduces the amount of interest payments that we have to make on the debt. So that means less of the budget is going to interest payments. More of the budget can go to other things that actually provide value to constituents. So the state's pretty smart to be doing that.
Florida also got a boost by shrinking the policies held under Citizens Property Insurance Corporation. The company is known as the state's insurer of last resort. It provides coverage for high-risk properties like oceanfront homes. Citizens has shifted two-thirds of its policies to private insurers, reducing the state's catastrophic risk exposure. The move has been controversial, as some of those companies were undercapitalized early on. But with all of these improvements, the state now has a top-tier AAA credit rating from three financial services companies, including Moody's. Holcomb says that's a good thing for Florida taxpayers.
Florida's one of the best states as far as credit ratings. And you go to other states that are having debt problems, states like Illinois, like California, not only do they have a lot more debt, they also have to pay higher interest rates on the debt.
The governor's office calls this the largest reduction of state debt during one administration in Florida's history. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Okay, enough of the happy stuff. Florida's primary election happens a week from this coming Tuesday, so let's dive back into the political grind, shall we? Florida's top leadership offices are up for grabs this year, and one of the largest jobs is overseeing the state's multi-billion dollar agriculture and consumer services industries. There are seven candidates vying to succeed Adam Putnam as agriculture commissioner. Five of them recently appeared before several South Florida editorial boards to make their cases to voters. Lynn Hatter reports.
Homestead Mayor and Democrat Jeffrey Porter says South Florida farmers are hurting.
Over the years that I've been, involved, agriculture has really been under pressure and is literally dying in South Florida.
Porter and others point to a trade imbalance between the U.S. and Mexico when it comes to fruit and vegetable production. It's a microcosm of a larger national debate over trade between the United States and its regional partners. And it's playing out across varying Florida agricultural sectors. Take tomatoes, for example. Republican State Senator Denise Grimsley says many tomato farmers she knows are struggling to stay in business.
Or the $10 a box is the break-even number, but Mexico is bringing them in at $6 a box. And I believe their intention eventually is to put all of our guys out of business. And the commissioner needs to be out ahead of that.
Grimsley's family raises cattle and grows citrus. One area where both the Republican and Democratic candidates agree is on a desire to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Growers are also dealing with a 70% decline in the state's hallmark citrus crop due to a greening disease. The candidates differ on how to address that issue. Democrat Nikki Fried is an attorney and marijuana advocate. She's floating the idea of legalizing the drug for recreational use in order to promote industrial hemp farming to replace citrus.
And so once we go into a legalization format, then it is just an agricultural crop. And there's going to be a movement to actually take Department of Medical Marijuana Use and move it into the Department of Agriculture.
Grimsley also thinks hemp could work, but she's against the recreational use. So is Democrat Porter and Republican primary challenger Matt Caldwell. All candidates say they support medical marijuana, which Caldwell helped craft legislation for as a state representative.
What I would like to see is more licensees to meet the market demand for those products. I know DOH did not want to have this responsibility. It's clear from how they've handled it since the day we gave it to them that they didn't want to have this responsibility. If that attitude continues with whoever's the next governor, I'd be more than happy to take over the program wholly inside the Department of Agriculture.
The agriculture commissioner is also a member of the state clemency board, and he has a say on whether to restore certain rights back to people who have completed their sentences. Several court cases have ruled Florida's current process is broken, but the candidates all have different views on how they'd improve it. Democrats in the race support an automatic process like the one that's being floated to voters through Amendment 4 on the November ballot. The Republicans favor a more nuanced approach. They want to keep that power with the cabinet, but allow expedited hearings for white-collar, nonviolent, and first-time offenders. Then there's water quality. Amid a persistent red tide and toxic algae blooms produced by polluted runoff in Lake Okeechobee, Democrat Roy Walker, an environmental scientist who used to work at the State Wildlife Commission, wants to do more to address climate change. He argues in order to have a real impact, the state is going to have to work with other agencies and industries.
As commissioner, your job is to make sure that different industries is using the best management practices, which is voluntary, not mandatory, to make sure they're not polluting our waterway, but they need to be held accountable when they do pollute.
The candidate spoke with reporters from WLRN, the Miami Herald, and Sun Sentinel editorial boards. Republican candidates Mike McAllister and Baxter Troutman did not attend. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
Still to come on Capitol Report, how did all those multi-subject constitutional amendments get onto the ballot Floridians will be voting on in November?
A lot of people, when they don't understand what they're being asked to vote on, will just either not vote or vote no.
We'll hear from the main author of Florida's controversial Stand Your Ground law.
We do not impose upon an innocent victim the obligation, the artificial obligation, of turning and running if he or she can do so.
And a campaign encouraging oil and gas drilling off Florida's coasts may not really be about Florida at all.
So if they can push back here and eliminate that bipartisan opposition, then they can head off efforts elsewhere as well.
A lawsuit in Florida's Supreme Court filed by a former justice seeks to get most of the Constitution Revision Commission's proposed amendments off the ballot before November. Harry Lee Anstead retired as Chief Justice in 2009. He takes issue with six amendments and their combining proposed changes. Well, Martha Barnett is an attorney who served on the last Constitution Revision Commission back in 1998. She served on its Style and Drafting Committee, which determines how amendments are combined and presented on the ballot. Barnett recently spoke with Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly about her experience on the commission and gave her take on the most recent amendments.
Was the concept of bundling, was that ever brought up amongst you and your peers on that Style and Drafting Committee, or is this something they're trying out kind of for the first time?
Well, the concept of, quote, bundling wasn't discussed as bundling, but the idea of putting more than one proposed amendment to the Constitution in a proposal was not only discussed, but we did that. If you look back at the proposals that the CRC, the 98 CRC, put on the ballot, several of them are just deal with one subject, but many of them had multiple topics contained within the ballot proposal. So what this commission is doing conceptually was done, I know with our commission, and I believe it was done with the 78 commission. There are differences, at least that I perceive, in our approach to that with what has been the result of what the current commission has done, in that we tried to bundle, I'm using your word, but we tried to combine. I think we would have looked at it as more combining proposals that had some intrinsic relationship to each other. They may have related to different parts of the Constitution, but they were not totally disparate in impact, a topic, or effect, more topical, more conceptual, with some relationship between them that would make sense to the voter. One of the benefits of the CRC, some people would say it's not a benefit, but one of the differences with the CRC as opposed to a joint resolution or a citizens initiative is the concept of single subject doesn't apply. You can, it was always been contemplated that you could have in a proposal issues that were more than a single subject. So that, what they're doing, there is nothing about what they, the process that they have engaged in that is atypical or that was unexpected for the CRC. What I perceive, Ryan, that is problematic is the almost dumping totally unrelated concepts into a proposal and creating either the impression or the reality that if you want this one issue to pass,
you got to take these other two that you may not care about, may not understand, or may actually be opposed to.
That sort of combining together of things that don't, at least on the surface, especially to the voter who hasn't been following it, connect with each other or line up. Where does that leave some of these amendments that are going to be on the ballot, and what would be your take on, you know, their chances of passing?
I think that the confusion that has resulted and the discussion and the debate and the litigation that has come out of this has not been helpful. A lot of people, when they don't understand what they're being asked to vote on, will just either not vote or vote no. And when you need 60% of the vote to pass a proposal, not voting, you know, is a no vote in some ways. So the confusion, I think, is not helpful to getting them passed. The reaction of many people who do pay attention to this has been that there appeared to be a deliberate effort to put, you know, combine things people might really want, such as banning offshore drilling, with something you really don't care about at all, or you might be opposed to. And I don't know about the intent behind it, but I do think it has created a negative public opinion.
Well, Martha, thank you so much for joining me, and I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly speaking with 1998 Florida Constitution Revision Commission member Martha Barnett. Last week, Florida's Stand Your Ground law took center stage as people rallied, protested, and marched over the killing of a black unarmed man during a dispute over a handicapped parking space. The shooter, a white man, was never arrested. That is, until earlier this week, when the Pinellas County State Attorney decided to file charges. Last week, Sasha Cordner spoke to the main author of Stand Your Ground, who weighed in on the case and the law before the charges were filed. But she starts off first with what led us up to this point.
On Monday, Pinellas County State Attorney Bernie McCabe announced his office would be pursuing manslaughter charges against Michael Draca over his shooting of Marquise McLaughlin last month. That's after weeks of him not facing arrest following the shooting. McLaughlin's girlfriend illegally parked in a handicapped spot while McLaughlin went inside a Clearwater convenience store. Draca then confronted her about parking there without a permit. Surveillance video shows Draca firing the shots after McLaughlin came out of the store and shoved Draca to the ground. At the time, Draca had claimed self-defense, and Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri said he was just following the law.
My decision not to arrest is because Florida law creates a situation where someone is immune from arrest if their conduct is arguably within the parameters of Stand Your Ground.
Still, he also acknowledged that Draca could still face charges for fatally shooting McLaughlin. And now with Draca's recent arrest, Gualtieri says he'll, quote, support the state attorney's decision. While McLaughlin's family says they're now pleased with Draca's arrest, Tampa attorney Michelle Rayner says he should have been arrested then. Rayner is part of the attorney team representing the family.
When I talk to my clients about Stand Your Ground, it's down at the county jail. It's not at home, and they're not eating their Fruit Loops, they're not resting. I have to go to jail and talk to them because they've been arrested at the scene. Yeah. Why did this not happen here? And what color are they? Yeah. We already know the answer to that.
Court records show Draca had been involved with other incidents like this, two of which involved Draca displaying a gun. Tallahassee attorney Ben Crump also represents the McLaughlin family.
This was nothing new. Him confronting black and brown people. And I guess with the national leadership, they feel even more emboldened to confront black and brown people, to take the law into their own hands.
There have also been bipartisan agreement that Stand Your Ground did not apply in this case, but there are still some Republicans that say it could.
I believe that Florida's self-defense laws apply. And what is called Stand Your Ground is a very small and distinct portion of the existing self-defense laws here in the state of Florida.
That's Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons, who is the main author of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. He says to understand whether it applies, the law first must be understood. Simmons adds the state of Florida does not impose upon an innocent victim the, quote, artificial obligation of turning and running if he or she can do so.
Did you act reasonably under all the circumstances by reasonably, and that's objectively reasonably, believe that the use of deadly force was necessary in order to avoid, prevent imminent death or great bodily injury?
So he says Draca's case needs to be looked at within those parameters.
Was Mr. Draca acting reasonably and within the set of restrictions and criteria that Florida, as well as almost every other state, imposes on its citizens who are acting in self-defense? And these are the things that law enforcement and the state attorney's office, I suggest, according to the statute, be looked at.
Meanwhile, since McLaughlin's death, there have been repeated calls for appeal of Stand Your Ground, but Simmons says taking a look at other states and past court rulings, it's working. He points to an example of a woman attacked at a shopping center by a man who says he'll rape and kill her.
I ask you this, are you going to impose upon her the obligation as an innocent person to be second-guessed that she needs to in high heels or whatever else to try to turn and run rather than use deadly force to protect herself? I think the resounding answer to that is we don't need to be second-guessing her, just like the United States Supreme Court in 1920 said.
As for Draca, his bond is set at $100,000. If he does make bail, a Pinellas County judge has said he'll have to surrender his guns, wear an ankle monitor, and not leave the county. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, back in early June, Capitol Report featured a story about a new coalition that wanted to open up more of the Atlantic and Gulf coastal regions to oil and natural gas exploration. But that was just a soft opening for the campaign. On August 15th, that coalition kicked off its Florida effort in a much bigger way. The scene was the Florida Press Center in Tallahassee. Former U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Jim Nicholson, now the co-chair of the Explore Offshore Group, told a room full of reporters how America had become a net energy producer through more aggressive land-based oil and natural gas recovery in recent years. But he also insisted vast resources of potential domestic fossil fuel resources remained undiscovered.
It's been more than three decades, more than 30 years, since we've had the chance to explore many areas in the outer continental shelf. Our government estimates suggest that there could be as much as nearly 90 billion barrels of oil and 327 trillion cubic feet of natural gas discoverable in our own outer continental shelf.
But since there's been no exploration, explained Nicholson, those potential riches remained undiscovered and untapped.
By keeping 94% of our offshore territory closed to natural gas and oil exploration, we're voluntarily giving up hundreds of thousands of jobs and billions of barrels of energy supply that is essential to our country's future energy security.
The coalition is backed by the American Petroleum Institute and its state affiliates like the Florida Petroleum Council. It would like to see rigs come as close as 75 miles to Florida's coastline. Under present restrictions, no rig is closer than 200 miles. Even so, Nicholson said there would be few, if any, oil wells spoiling the seaward vistas for beachgoers.
There is little or no chance of this exploration being visible from the coastal lands, and the miracle of new science and technology has made the chances of a disastrous accident like that of the BP Deepwater Horizon in 2010 nearly impossible.
That last point was reemphasized by Florida Explore Offshore co-chair and former Lieutenant Governor Jeff Kottkamp. He went even further, suggesting the spill didn't really hurt Florida at all, much to the shock of the reporters in the room.
That was the worst spill, you know, in the history of Florida, and didn't even reach the shores of Florida.
Well, except on the coast, and
those are naturally occurring, I think, as we know.
Outraged pushback from Florida environmental groups wasn't long in coming, such as Earth Justice, where Bradley Marshall is a Tallahassee-based attorney.
The slogan, drill, baby, drill, is not getting the traction it quite used to. And so now they're trying a different tact and saying, well, what's the harm in exploring to see what's there? And of course, the only reason you would want to explore is to look for large reserves that could then be extracted.
And while the explore offshore folks tout the jobs and economic benefits such exploration and possible energy production might bring to Florida, Marshall worried such activity could put far more existing jobs and revenue at risk.
In Florida, we have millions of jobs in the tourism industry that are dependent on making sure that we have inviting beaches for people to go to. An oil spill off of Florida's shores would simply be catastrophic for our economy and our environment.
There's still the question of why the possibility of offshore drilling is even being advanced right now. Certainly those in the industry aren't kindly disposed towards the proposed constitutional amendment fracking ban that's still on the November ballot in Florida. And despite an earlier assurance from U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to Governor Scott that Florida was, in his words, off the table for offshore drilling, the Trump administration has been aggressively pushing for more domestic fossil fuel production. So Earth Justice's Bradley speculates that Florida may not even be the campaign's primary target at all, especially since more than a few energy experts have opined that the Sunshine State's geology may not be a very productive hunting ground for extensive new oil and natural gas reserves.
Florida has had a long history of bipartisan opposition to offshore drilling, and I certainly think the industry does not want to see that spread to other states. And so if they can push back here and eliminate that bipartisan opposition, then they can head off efforts elsewhere as well.
In the meantime, David Micah, who heads the Florida Petroleum Council, thinks the new Explore Offshore initiative will simply encourage more debate on the matter.
We're believing that this coalition will give a voice to the many unheard of folks that are very supportive of offshore energy in the United States, and ultimately aim to provide a more favorable public opinion of what we try to do to bring us the energy resources we need.
Expect to hear more from those previously unheard folks as time goes on. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.